the Nightmare Society. This happened about 2 years ago, in my second year at university. I was 20 years old. For context, I'm French. So if anything's weird about how I describe university experience, that's probably why. At the time, I lived in a government-owned apartment building, third floor. My direct neighbor was my younger sister, who was studying in the same university as me. One other thing important to the story is that I'm disabled. My right leg is useless after an accident when I was 13, and I suffer from debilitating chronic pain. To a degree, it keeps me bedridden and nonverbal unless I take a twice-a-day dosage of prescribed morphine. All of that is important details, so please bear with me. When I take my medication, I'm able to leave my bed. On the worst days, I have to either use a wheelchair or a cane to get around. Isn't that great that we lived on the third floor of a building with no elevator? On top of that, as you might guess, morphine is a very strong pain medication. It screws with your visual and hearing perception. It makes you sleepy and dizzy, lessens your reflexes, numbs your nervous system, makes you paranoid. You get the idea. At the time, I had only been taking morphine for less than 6 months, after 10 years of various other pain medication, and I was still dealing with the side effects in full force. Most of them are gone now. So for me, that meant mainly auditory hallucinations, sleepiness, dizziness, and bad reflex / nervous response. At that point, I had gotten used to hearing stuff that wasn't there, mostly clapping noises, clicking noises, small things, ultimately. I never hallucinated human voices. That night, I had gone out to the center of the city to meet with my friends. This was a rare occasion for me, and I do mean rare. I didn't go out more than once every 2 months or so, for multiple reasons that my friends, bless them, understood perfectly. Morphine means no drinking, so that's half of the fun going to the bar removed from the start. Despite the very useful nature of the meds, I was still, and still am, in a tremendous amount of pain if I stand for more than a couple of minutes, and I was sure to do a lot of that at the bar, plus walking back from the bus stop to my building, about a 5-minute walk. But I went anyway. For a few days, there had been rumors going around about a group that was going around kidnapping people from my university. From memory, 2 girls had disappeared already, and it was suspected that a blue van was the vehicle used. Those reports were circulating on our major's group and on the university's group as well, about the same details each time. But my friends and I were skeptical, mostly about the blue van, because we didn't believe the van would still be running around if the information had spread enough that we were hearing about it on Facebook, you know? Not that I was thinking about any of that as I came back from the bar around midnight. Early, I know, but I was in a lot of pain and the bus stops at 12:30, and missing it would mean waking up my sister so she could pick me up at the tram station, since I was physically unable to walk the 20 minutes required. I got into the bus. Only 3 people were there, and none got out at my bus stop. Now bear in mind that I was in extreme amount of pain, so much that my vision was blurring out on the edges, and I was swaying a bit from side to side, trying to minimize the weight being put on my leg. On top of that, I had just taken a fast-working morphine dose to help me get through the 5 minutes walk back to my building. And unlike my twice-a-day high dose, these pills I could take to my discretion whenever I needed a quick relief. The downside of that very practical pill is that it basically knocks you out in 30 minutes. You get so sleepy you can barely keep your eyes open. And basically, you're high for about 20 minutes before either passing out or getting through it, and it gets better after a while. I get out of the bus. On my right is a parking lot in front of a bakery with a lot of cars. That's normal because there are a lot of government-owned student flats around that block, and that's where most of them park, so I'm not concerned. The road I take is straight from where the bus dropped me off, for the whole walk before my building is to the right. A couple of parking spots in front of it and a wheelchair slope go to a magnetic door. You need your magnetic student ID to open the door, then a key to the specific door to your building. As I walk by the parking lot, I see movement in the corner of my eye, but since I'm half out of it from pain and medication, I don't turn to look at it. I hear some noise and I just assume I'm hallucinating, so I keep on walking. But then the street lights reflect on a car window, and I don't know why that made me turn around. My brain was catching on to weird stuff, so I briefly look to the side, and I see an old, beat-up white car, pretty long and low to the ground. On the driver's side is an Algerian man in his mid-50s, the neighborhood being half students, half France-born Algerian. The thing that gives me pause is more the fact that there's someone awake in the front seat of a car at 1 in the morning. But again, I'm out of it, so I don't question it. I don't even stop walking because at this point my only thought is put one foot in front of the other. There you go, you're almost there, you're almost done with the pain. Literally all my attention, my focus, was put on putting one foot after the other because of this debilitating pain. I walk past the small roundabout to my left, still going straight, when I hear a car starting. I don't know why that was the thing that slapped me in the face, but suddenly I was worried. My heart was beating fast, probably half the meds and half the fear. But also, I was well aware that morphine tends to make me paranoid, so I tried to calm down. I see the headlights coming from behind me, drawing a long shadow in front of me. In a second, I run through the calculations. I'm still about 300 meters, say 1,000 feet, from my building. Then I need to get out my ID and open the door. A slow, automatic, magnetic door. I can't run, I can barely walk. I'm up to the head in morphine. It's the middle of the night, I'm alone, with no residential building close enough to hear a scream. That's when I start to panic. I'm right to do so. The car matches up to me, slows down to my walking speed. I notice that the man is not alone in the car anymore. Someone is, in fact, in the passenger seat, and there's movement in the back as well, but I don't turn my head because I try to pretend I don't notice them slowing down. I had my earphones in with no music, as I didn't turn it back on after the bus ride. I just keep walking, hoping with everything I have that they'll leave me alone. I'm trying to walk faster, but I'm in so much pain a few tears fall down. I can hear that they're calling for my attention, but I'm not listening to what they're saying. Finally, I see the lane going up to my building. I take off my backpack and I shove my hand down in the front pocket, fumbling because my nervous system is shite, thanks to the medication, and I cannot feel my fingers, and I'm shaking like crazy. And I can't find my ID. At that point, I'm close to a panic attack. My heart is beating too fast and I'm feeling close to fainting from the combined pain and terror. I turn to face the wheelchair slope when I see from the corner of my eye the car stopping abruptly right next to the slope and the car door slamming open. I don't know how I did it because I was so close to fainting. But I managed to run the last 10 feet to the door and slap my ID on the reader, yelling at the door to open faster. I could hear people running behind me. The door finally opened enough for me to slip in, and I slammed it shut behind me. I heard the men run to the door with a loud noise, and them cursing, then yelling things to me. I didn't stick around to hear what they had to say. I fumbled with my keys to the point of almost dropping them before opening the door to my flat complex. I got inside on shaky legs, and as soon as the door closed behind me, I dropped to the floor and had the worst panic attack of my life. When I managed to put myself back together and painstakingly climb the 3 flights of stairs, I crawled into my sister's flat. We left our doors open for each other for precisely these circumstances, and woke her up telling her the whole story. She told me later I was deathly pale, so much that I scared her enough that she offered for me to share her single bed that night. I was too messed up to refuse. The worst part is, this isn't the end of the story. My sister went out to bars a lot more than I did, and she's able-bodied and drop-dead gorgeous. About 3 weeks later, she called me in the middle of the night as she was coming back from a bar. She had seen the exact car I described in the parking lot at the bus stop. She didn't stop to see if there was anyone inside. She reacted and sprinted to our building. Of course, she was a lot faster than my drugged, disabled butt, but she made it to the door where I was waiting for her, having it opened from the inside just as the car stopped in the lane. After that, we left a note at our flat complex's door to explain everything to other people, posted about it on every university group we knew of, and we contacted the police, who helpfully told us they could do nothing without catching them in the act, but that they'd probably send someone to patrol, as it matched the reports they had gotten that sparked the whole blue van rumors in the first place. In the following year it took to finish my degree, neither me nor my sister saw those men or their car again, but we still hear from people the same kind of story being shared from other parts of the city. As far as we can tell, they're still active, and 2 years later, I'm still really messed up about it. It was a long time ago, before cell phones were prevalent, and I was a mom in my early 30s who had just driven our kids to the pediatrician. The Macon, Georgia doctor's office was an hour away from our home, and I was just taking the two youngest of my three, at that time ages 1 and 3 years old, to our scheduled appointment. Because we lived so far away, their office always gave us the last two appointments of the day, and we were grateful. The doctor had just built a new building off of a fresh spur of the highway, so the location was quite isolated in every direction, but a very nice facility compared to his old spot by the hospital there. His new building was also pretty far back off the road, on a new lot, and my car, a black Jeep Cherokee we had owned for 2 years, was one of the only four or five cars in the parking lot when I arrived. I parked near the front door, removed the kids from their car seats, and for the next hour or so we waited, then saw the doctor, paid, and finally exited back outside. Mine was the only car left in the lot as I loaded the children in their car seats for our trip home. But as the receptionist locked the front glass doors, my car somehow wouldn't start when I turned the key. There was just an odd clicking noise. Gathering the children once again, I knocked on the door until someone allowed us back in and asked to borrow their phone to call a nearby garage for service. I found one in the phone book and the man said that he would come, but that it might be a bit, so I told him my location, left to go back out to the car, rolled down all the windows, and loaded the children back into the car, and waited. Soon we watched as all the lights were turned out in the building again and everyone left, their cars departing one by one from behind the building somewhere, leaving us now completely alone in the parking lot. As it was still light, I spent a lot of that time trying to tend to the children, digging through our car for snacks and a bottle, making sure that they weren't getting too hot, etc. Although the service station attendant said that it was probably going to be quite a while, I was pleasantly surprised when a truck pulled into the empty parking lot pretty soon, and a man got out of his pickup, smiled and nodded to me, and said he was going to raise the hood. He was middle-aged and a bit scruffy, but quite frankly, many gas station attendants sometimes looked that way, especially at the end of the day, and I was grateful when he began doing something under the hood almost immediately. I sat down again in the driver's seat with the door open, waiting for him to tell me to try the engine, but he seemed to be taking a long time checking the connections, and I longed for him to just grab the jumper cables, yet he never did. Without getting out of the car, I asked him what he thought was wrong, and he said,
"Oh, it's just a loose wire, not the battery."
And continued whatever he was doing. I couldn't see his face at all from where I was sitting, but his hands were slightly visible through that long horizontal slit between the windshield and the raised hood as we waited. More than once he said that it was merely a loose wire, and if I would just come up there and really quick he would show me which one it was, so it would never happen again. I remember kind of smiling and shaking my head, saying that sadly there was no reason to show me anything, as I didn't know anything about cars. I just thanked him and continued to stay in the driver's seat, again just waiting for the inevitable signal to try to start the ignition that was most surely coming at any moment. At one point, I remember thinking that he was definitely flirting as he spoke, but I was trying to, above all, be polite and kind, as he was indeed helping us. We were hot and tired and miserable, and truthfully, I was distracted with the kids. Oddly enough, he was starting to sound a little frustrated with me because I wouldn't come up and look at the engine. I remember thinking that I certainly didn't want to make him mad where he left us there all alone, with the sun sinking so quickly. And then the strangest thing happened. Another truck suddenly pulled into that desolate parking lot, and as it did, this nice guy working underneath my hood suddenly slammed it shut, ran to his truck, started it, drove away very quickly, without even saying a word of goodbye. I was both confused and a little anxious when he did this, because I didn't know who was now arriving. I even remember feeling a little frightened that he had suddenly left me there alone with two little ones, defenseless. Why wouldn't he at least stay and speak to whoever was parking next to me now? It certainly seemed the southerly gentleman thing to do. I looked around and was very aware once again that there were no visible cars on the road, no homes or businesses nearby, and the sun was continuing to set quickly. As this new, also unmarked pickup pulled in next to me, I got out of the car once again, this time more apprehensively. Upon exiting, though, he immediately introduced himself, and his name and voice seemed to match who I spoke to on the phone much earlier. He then actually called me by name, apologized for being so late, and finally smiled and stared towards the road, pointing and asking who the man was who had just left so suddenly. Relieved and unfazed, I just smiled back in surprise and told him, "Well, I don't know. I thought all this time he was you." And we both laughed slightly as he then grabbed jumper cables, walked to the front of my car, raised the hood, and started to work. I immediately sat back in the driver's seat once more, suddenly grateful that, with luck, that air conditioner would be blowing full blast shortly, and once again checking the children. While listening for him to ask me to try it, I had my back completely turned towards the children, when he surprised me by suddenly coming to the driver's side door. In the strangest voice, he said,
Ma'am, is this yours?
And when I looked into his hands, he was holding a long, thin, dagger-like looking device that was about a foot and a half in length. It appeared to be very old and covered with reddish rust, yet on one end it had circular small finger holes, as if it was a mix of a long, thin sword and scissors, oddly combined. I remember being amazed but not frightened, and I asked where he had found them, and he said that he found them under my hood. I said just matter-of-factly that I had never seen them before, but how weird was it that those things had somehow been stuck and undiscovered in my car for all those years, and shook my head in surprise. He continued to stand there and stare at them, unbelievingly, and he looked oddly pale too, like he couldn't find the words to speak for a bit, just continuing to stare at the unusual object. Honestly, I didn't care one bit about it. All I could think of was getting the car going, letting me pay him and the cost, and leaving. He didn't say anything else, just quickly set them on the curb, started his truck, and then signaled for me to start the Jeep. And when immediately it caught, my three-year-old cheered. Grateful, I quickly turned on the air conditioner full blast, rolled up all the windows, aimed the air vents back towards the back seat, and reached for my purse to pay out. I stood up and took a few steps to meet him so I could hear the amount now owed. We both had our vehicles running. He came back around to the driver's side, but instead of handing me the bill, irritated me a bit by walking right past me and picking up that weird object once more.
Ma'am? I want you to look at these here one more time.
He said slowly and held them out for closer inspection. This time I moved a bit closer and actually really looked. In his hands, the item still appeared incredibly large, possessing an almost bayonet-looking quality, except for the strangely small two loops on one end. I had never seen anything like it, and I told him so. As he held it, he spoke quietly and slowly to me, as if trying desperately to make me understand something that was somehow still going over my head.
These were not hidden somewhere in the engine, ma'am. They hadn't been there very long at all, because they were sitting right on top. They must have just been put there.
I shook my head no and half smiled as I told him they are obviously very old and rusty, to which he pointed more closely and said,
"Yeah, but see how sharp they are? These look like they've just been sharpened."
And when I looked down, he was right. The long, skinny, dagger-like shape was unusual, but by far the oddest quality was just how sharp it appeared to be. The edges at the tip where the rust had been removed were gleaming silver. As I paid him, his final words to me were,
"Ma'am, I don't know what was about to happen here, but I'm really glad I pulled up when I did."
He quietly thanked me when taking the payment, told me that I probably needed to call the police when I got home, and then asked me where I wanted the item. I didn't want to touch it. I didn't want to take it at all. But I released the back window so he could place it inside. We both then left the lot together, him turning one way, me turning the other towards the small winding highway that would lead me home, still an hour away. I did, indeed, contact the Macon police the moment that we arrived home and I got the children inside safely. But although they listened politely, they declined when I offered to bring the scissor-like thing to them later. The officer I spoke to said they sounded like they were specialized surgical shears from my description and measurements on the phone, which I found quite disturbing, as you can imagine. I remember wondering how he would have known that. Why would he say that? I had tried so carefully not to touch any of the surfaces, hoping that they might be able to lift prints or test it for blood if they wanted. But the story seemed to bore him a bit, and he didn't seem interested. His attitude insinuated that as there was no longer an emergency, it was of no importance now. At the very end of the call, as if to wind things up, he said that it sounded as if I was very lucky, and that I might want to keep the shears for a few days just in case someone from his office got back with me later. But that was all. I wrapped them carefully in newspaper and placed them in the brick storage unit behind our house, and there they remained for several more years, untouched, until we moved away and I finally, not wanting to bring them across several states, reluctantly threw them in the trash. Around that time, though, if you look through old news reports, women were going missing all over Georgia. Some bodies were eventually found, but others remain missing to this very day. I have often wondered what would have happened to me if the service station attendant had not arrived when he did. If my children would still have a mother. If I would still have had my son and daughter. If I would have missed all these years with them. I guess I'll never know. But I learned something very important about myself that day. I had always felt that I was pretty aware of my surroundings. Pretty good at reading people. And staying safe. But because I was exhausted and tired and hot and stranded in a different city, my common sense and intelligence simply left me for a bit and wasn't working at that time. And many of my friends and family still think that our car trouble that day and my lack of awareness could easily have cost us our lives. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget to head over to Instagram and follow the podcast at Nightmare Society Radio. And if you're interested in supporting the podcast, you can check out patreon.com/nightmare society. We've got pretty much a catalog of most of the older episodes that aren't available streaming through the podcast apps currently. And until next time.